Thank you. Is that on? Think so. Everybody hear me? Okay. I want to tell you about a new idea we had for direct detection of axion dark matter using some NMR techniques. This is work done with my theory collaborator, Surjit Rajendran, and then our experimental collaborators in Bhima Budker's group at Berkeley, who crucially keep us honest about, us theorists honest about what actually can be done with these experimental techniques. So, I guess after the previous talk, I don't need to motivate axions too much, but let me just say very briefly, two of the best dark matter candidates are WIMPs and axions. And of course, there are many excellent experiments searching for WIMP dark matter. But really, only one, ADMX, can look for axion dark matter. And as I'll argue, it's currently quite challenging to discover axions over most of their parameter space. So I think sort of a driving question for me has been, how do we find new ways to discover axions? I think it's very important to find new experiments that can look for axions. It would be a shame just to miss the dark matter if it is, in fact, axions. And there's, as was alluded to, there's many strong motivations for axions. So of course, the QCD axion can solve the strong CP problem. I'll think about a QCD axion, but also, as Pierre said, actually, it's interesting to just think about the more general class of axion-like particles. So I'll do that too. It's very easy to get axions from high-energy theories. Just need some global PQ symmetry broken at this high-scale FA, the axion decay constant. And for example, string theory, or really any theory with non-trivial topology in extra dimensions, naturally produces axions for you. And at least your theory prejudice might be to expect this scale of new physics, FA, to be around scales we already know about, fundamental scales like Planck scale, gut scale, string scale, things like that. Though, as I'll argue, really, you should look everywhere you can look. So here's my sort of crude cartoon of QCD axion parameter space. I'll start talking about just the QCD axion. I'll show you in general, though, results for axion-like particles at the end. So here's this axion decay constant, FA, all the way up to the Planck scale. And as was mentioned, anywhere above around 10 to the 11 GeV or so, the axion can be dark matter. Below about 10 to the 9 GeV, the axion is ruled out by a combination of astrophysical limits from supernova 1987A and white dwarfs, other astrophysical objects, also a combination of collider and laser experiments. So for example, around here is where these laser experiments like ALPS, light through wall searches, are most relevant. So all of these searches rely on this coupling of the axion to photons, coupling to FF dual, F being the field strength of E and M. And of course, all couplings are suppressed by FA, this axion decay constant. Or in other words, this is a coupling to electric dot magnetic fields. And of course, all the searches rely on this because E and B fields are easy things to manipulate in the lab. OK, so of course, the way these light through walls experiments work, some laser beam comes in through a region of background magnetic field. Through this vertex, the laser photon converts to an axion, which passes through, say, a screen there. That can reconvert through this vertex again off the background magnetic field into some photon on the other side of the wall, which you can detect. But then, of course, you can immediately see the issue. It's a great experiment. They do a great job. But you can see the issue with getting up into this dark matter region, getting up to high F. You have two insertions of this vertex. So your amplitude is suppressed like 1 over F squared. And F is a very big scale here. F is the big suppression for the axion, right? It makes the axion very weakly coupled. And since they're measuring a rate, you square that, so they get a suppression like 1 over F to the 4th. So while it works great down here, I think it's going to be very challenging to push these laser experiments up to see anything in the dark matter window. Sorry, put that down a little. OK, the one experiment that can look for axion dark matter, ADMX, works as was mentioned in the previous talk. Here's their resonant microwave cavity. Dark matter axion comes in, converts off the background B field into some excitation of the cavity, some excitation of some cavity mode. You look for that. Since you only have one vertex here, of course, very naively, your rate for axion to photon conversion is only suppressed like 1 over F squared. That's better, already telling you why you can go up to higher F. There is an issue, though. So I've marked out here my sort of very crude guess as to what these sort of Sakivi cavity techniques could one day cover. There's an issue with going to even higher F, which is that this is a resonant experiment. So the size of the cavity, the resonant frequency of the cavity needs to be matched to the axion frequency, the axion mass. The XN mass, that's the wavelength, and the cavity frequency is set by the cavity size, so that means the size of the cavity needs to be matched roughly to the axion wavelength. So all couplings of the axion are suppressed by F. So down here, you have an axion wavelength which is about this big or so, so you can happily make a cavity that big. But as F goes up, the mass goes down, so the wavelength goes up. So if you want to look for axions, let's say, with an F around the gut scale, you would have to make a cavity that's about 300 meters in size. So to me, that sounds very challenging. I don't know. I don't want to judge what can or can't be done experimentally. But if you can no longer build a cavity that's resonant, then your signal falls off much faster, something like 1 over F cubed. That's my crude guess. In any case, I think it makes it clear that it's going to be, these are fantastic techniques and excellent for looking over this lower dark matter parameter space. But I think it makes it clear that it's going to be very hard to look over the higher Fs, the higher axion decay constants near the fundamental scales. So that was a question for me. If the axion is the dark matter, and let's say it sits in this parameter space, and I'll address the cosmological limit in just a second. If it sits in this parameter space, are we just going to miss it? Are we not going to find the dark matter? I should mention that I'm aware of one Thomas, which is sort of similar to this microwave cavity experiment, which can push up using an LC circuit, essentially. It can push up this upper bound maybe to some extent, but it still suffers from these F suppressions. Essentially, as F is going up, the coupling of the axion is getting weaker and weaker. The axion wavelength is getting longer. Your experiments are always losing sensitivity. In fact, in particular, if you want to say it another way, this FF dual operator is a total derivative. So you can integrate by parts, put the derivative on the axion. You always get an axion mass suppression, or in other words, a 1 over axion wavelength suppression. And it pretty much always comes in. I spent a lot of time trying to come up with new experiments, ways to get into this region. So as a rule of thumb, I can tell you it pretty much always comes in as size of your experiment over wavelength of the axion, usually squared. So unless you can build experiments that are hundreds of meters or kilometers, it's very challenging to get up into this region. Okay. So like I said, I think one major question is, how do we look for these high FA axions? Let's see, I can just skip rapidly through this since it was more or less covered by Pierre. The way I would say it is, well, the main difference, what I mean by the main difference between a WIMP is something which has very low phase space density, right? I mean, there's one WIMP in this cube of space here. An axion, by contrast, really, I'll just be talking about axion-like particles, is something with very high phase space density. I will think of it, or describe it at least for the purpose of this talk, mostly as a classical field. And just the main point to take away, I think the intuition which helped me was, you know, when you're looking for a WIMP, since it has such low phase space density, you're just talking about interacting with a single particle, right? You're looking for the single hit in xenon 100 or whatever, right? Single energy deposition. The axion is very weakly coupled and very light. You can't do at all like that. I think the trick, though, to get around these big high F suppressions is to search for coherent effects of the entire axion field. So that's just hand-waving intuition. I'll show you our experiment in a second, but I think that more or less roughly describes why you could hope to get to such high Fs, such weak couplings. Okay, so sort of my analogy is sort of like looking for the coherent interaction of an atom with a laser beam as opposed to the hard scattering of a gamma ray off a detector. So the gamma ray is more like a WIMP detection. Okay, and again, I just very briefly mentioned, as was mentioned by Pierre, so the axion dark matter is produced through the misalignment mechanism. Sometime in the early universe, after inflation, the axion starts with a more or less constant field. After the QCD phase transition, the mass turns on, the axion oscillates rapidly, gets damped down to the minimum by Hubble friction. And as we know, the axion can naturally produce a good cold dark matter candidate. In fact, we know more or less, very approximately, not into anything like the level of details was discussed in the previous talk, what the axion dark matter looks like. Of course, it's a essentially free scalar field, so it oscillates with a frequency set by its mass and some amplitude. Just to my way of saying this cosmological limit would be, the axion can actually produce the right dark matter abundance if you satisfy this one criterion here. This is the initial angle, so the initial displacement angle of the axion field. And this is the dimensionless, relevant dimensionless decay constant, FA over M Planck. So this needs to be a somewhat small dimensionless number. Okay, so that's, if you like, that's the small number associated with axion dark matter. Actually, you can even ease that by having late time entropy production, but even not assuming that that's your small number, I think the old way of referring to this axion window was to argue that A over F, the initial theta angle, had to be order 1, and you take FA over M Planck to be a small number. Personally, though, I think, to summarize a very long discussion, I would say I don't think I know enough about the beginning of the universe. Certainly, the more we think about inflationary cosmology, the more confused I get, let's say, about questions of measure and things like that. So I don't think I know enough to be able to say that I should take a flat measure, a flat prior in theta, over a flat prior in F. Actually, probably a flat prior in either variable is wrong. So theta is some historical parameter. It's how our chunk of the universe started. I don't know what that value should be. In fact, as you can see, by the way, this relation is approximate, even these powers are approximate. Because of this approximate square root here, as you raise F above what was previously called the cosmological limit around 10 to the 12 GeV, theta has to become somewhat small, but very slowly. So even all the way up at the gut scale, theta is only order 10 to the minus 2. So I'd argue at the very least that that cosmological upper bound is rather soft. And in fact, though, as I said, I don't see any reason for believing a flat prior in one variable or another. Okay, so this is just, if you like, my motivation for thinking that we should look everywhere we can look. We should look at all values of the axion decay constant. And like I said before, it would be a real shame if we can't detect axion dark matter if that FA is up near fundamental scale. Okay, so we said that all the previous ideas can't reach high FA for the very reasonable reason that as FA goes up, the wavelength goes up. And this is a derivative operator. Also, as FA goes up, the coupling goes down. The idea, then, our idea, is to use a different operator. Use a different coupling of the axion. Instead of using its coupling to FF dual, field strength of E and M, to photons, use the defining coupling of the QCD axion, the fact that it couples to GG dual, where G is the field strength of QCD. So, of course, if we remember the strong CP problem, we know what that does. In the standard model, there was this dimensionless parameter theta coupling to GG dual. And physically, it's one physical effect, essentially, was to create a nucleon EDM proportional to that theta. Of course, the strong CP problem was the problem that we've measured. We've looked for nucleon EDMs, and that required theta to be small. The axion solves that by turning theta into this dynamical variable, A over F. This axion field picks up a mass. But then you can see, of course, so long as the physics I'm talking about is in the adiabatic limit, where the physics is slow, the scale of the nuclear physics is fast compared to whatever I'm talking about, the axion will clearly then create a nuclear EDM proportional now to the effective theta. So in other words, whatever is the local value of your axion field, A over F, at the position of the nucleus you're talking about, that's the EDM that will be created in your nucleus. So now it's a dynamical EDM. And in fact, we know approximately that what A is, very roughly. By the way, this is very rough. I'll use a more reasonable thing to set limits, but just for the purpose of this talk. A is an oscillating field, of course, oscillating with the frequency of the axion. That's what the mass does. And we even know the mass. The mass is roughly lambda QCD squared over F. If F is around gut scale, let's say, putting this in frequency units, that's about megahertz. Or in general, over this whole range of F might run anywhere from kilohertz to tens of gigahertz. Those are very laboratory frequencies. Right? That's something you can probe, even though this is coming from very high-scale physics. So that's part of what's exciting. We also know the strength of this, roughly. We know the strength of this axion field. Of course, it's set. If the axion is going to, I will assume the axion makes up all of the dark matter. So if the axion makes up all the dark matter, this is the energy density in the axion field. So then m squared a squared, you set equal to the local dark matter density, which we know at least approximately. Because the mass goes like 1 over f, this quantity, then, m squared a squared, goes like a over f squared. So that sets your value for theta, for effective theta, a over f, if it's assuming the axion is all of your dark matter. And notice, very important fact, that is independent of f. So here, then, we have an effect, this nucleon EDM, oscillating at the frequency of the axion, sourced, which is a physical effect which is independent of f, does not decouple as f goes up. Right? So this is what makes you excited to think that this is a way to get into the high F region. This is why using this operator is better than using the FF dual operator. Any physical effect of the FF dual operator must decouple, of the photon coupling must decouple as F goes up. This doesn't. OK, so what are we going to do with this? The idea then is that if the axion is your dark matter, this background axion dark matter field gives every nucleon sitting in it a rapidly oscillating electric dipole moment. So for example, maybe the first thing that occurs to you, certainly the first thing that occurred to us, was that a proton floating around the galaxy is then a little antenna. It's a rapidly oscillating dipole moment, continually sucking energy out of the axion dark matter and re-radiating as electromagnetic waves, all with one very particular frequency, just the mass of the axion. So that might sound like the sort of thing you can look for. We were pretty excited for a while. Unfortunately, what I should say to summarize it is that we weren't able to think of anything, any plausibly observable signals that you could see using that. Yeah, no, exactly. We're not going to solve the world's energy problem. It's a very small dipole. And we thought about neutron stars and things like that. We couldn't find any even plausibly observable signals. However, what you can do is sort of adapt or change some of the standard EDM search techniques to look for this oscillating EDM. Now, a priori, the two are very different, looking for a DC signal versus an AC signal. And as I'll show you in a second, all the standard EDM searches don't have any sensitivity to this kind of signal. And similarly, the experiment I'm talking about would have no sensitivity, essentially, to a static EDM. So we thought about two ideas. The first is that if every nucleus has this rapidly oscillating EDM, then that will affect, at some level, it must affect the electronic energy levels of the atom. We are, of course, extremely good at measuring electronic energy levels. That's what atomic clocks do. So in this first paper here, we wrote down in a sort of atomic clock type-based technology to look for to be a direct detection, axion direct detection experiment. Actually, I won't talk about that. I'll just focus on our newer idea, which is hopefully going to appear in a couple weeks, to look for the collective effects of this EDM using a condensed matter system, essentially to win with Avogadro's number because this is such a small effect. Okay, so to move on to our specific idea for detection, the basic idea would be as follows. Take your chunk of material, your sample of material, and align all the nuclear spins. This is non-trivial, but has been demonstrated in many different samples for many years now. And this alignment can persist, this macroscopic alignment can persist for a time in NMR language known as T1, which is many hours, or which is naturally many hours. So that's good. That's enough for us to do the experiment. Okay. So you have your external magnetic field, which is aligning all these magnetic dipole moments mu. But of course, if the axion is there, they're not just, these nuclear spins don't have just a magnetic dipole moment. They also have an electric dipole moment. So if you apply a perpendicular E field here to this material, if there is an EDM, that will cause these spins to all begin to precess around this external applied, or this applied E field. Once the spins begin to precess away from the original direction of magnetization, they will create some transverse magnetization, which you can pick up in a magnetometer. For example, we'll imagine a squid, since those are some of the best magnetometers that can be made. And I should say, this notion of looking for this transverse magnetization produced in this way is similar to or builds on some of the ideas for electron EDM experiments by Lamoureux and others. There's a crucial difference here, though. As I mentioned, our signal is AC, is oscillating. That creates a nice effect. Because this dipole moment is oscillating, you can see, right, it begins to precess around the electric field, but when pi out of phase, pi time, you know, half a period later, when the dipole moment has switched sign, it will then begin to precess the other way. So we wouldn't have a very big effect. But also, of course, really the biggest effect in town, once these spins are no longer oriented along the vertical, along the supplied external magnetic field, they will begin to precess because they have a magnetic dipole moment. They will begin to precess very rapidly at the Larmor frequency, mu b, around this external magnetic field. So if you match the Larmor frequency of precession, mu b, to the axion mass, to the frequency with which this dipole moment is oscillating, then you will get a resonant enhancement to your signal, to your transverse magnetization. Essentially, the way to see this is always hard. I can't draw it in 2D, but I'll try to show it in 3D here. As the spin begins to precess around the applied electric field, it also then precesses around the vertical. If you match it perfectly so that when it precesses around the vertical, it's gone exactly to the other side at the same time as the dipole moment is flip sign, then because the dipole moment flip sign, it will precess the other way around the electric field, which is still away from the vertical as opposed to back towards it. So sorry if that picture wasn't clear, but that's why you get this resonant enhancement. That's why the signal still builds up. And in fact, you can calculate it, and here is the signal. This is the transverse magnetization in this experiment. I don't want to go through it in too much detail, but let me just pick out a few important factors, which is first, you can see, of course, not surprisingly, what we wanted. We get an enhancement of Avogadro's number. It scales proportional to the number density of nuclei. We'll assume 10 to the 20. That, of course, is because your transverse magnetization is a coherent effect, right? All your nuclear spins are pointing slightly transverse. I should have mentioned, by the way, this is, of course, assuming that your sample is all within the axion wavelength, which is trivial because at these Fs that I'll really be interested in, the axion wavelength is, 100 meters or something. Well, obviously, we'll be taking a sample much smaller than that. That's why you can get a coherent effect. I should say also, I don't know what the best material will be. Actually, like I said, this is really just still a concept that we came up with. In fact, I think the situation may be rather like WIMP detection, where we discover over the years that many different materials have trade-offs, but you want to try a few different things. There are different materials, over the years, different materials have been leading in sensitivity for WIMP direct detection. I think there may be a similar story here, but let me just pick a material we know something about, sort of completely ad hoc, just because I have some numbers, say for lead 207, so I'll show you numbers that just to argue why order of magnitude, this is a promising experiment to do. This is an interesting experiment to consider. So, of course, the signal scale is proportional to this magnetic dipole moment. That's how much transverse magnetization you can get of the nucleus. Also, it's proportional to this shift suppression factor, which is essentially the fact that if you're looking for your nuclear dipole moment to interact with some external electric field applied to your atom, the electrons tend to rearrange themselves to screen that effect. That's the shift suppression factor. They would screen it perfectly if the nucleus was a point mass and if things were all non-relativistic, because there can't be any electric force on a charged object like the nucleus in electrostatic equilibrium. But of course, the nucleus is not a point mass, so there are corrections to that. That's this shift moment, essentially, which is really what you're looking for, not the EDM. And those scale proportional to Z. Actually, they scale like Z cubed, the Z of the nucleus, charge of the nucleus, which is why we're using such a high Z element. That's why all EDM experiments use high Z elements. But I did want to point out that, so that you can see the magnetic dipole moment of the lead nucleus is slightly even less than a nuclear magneton. There are certainly nuclei with better numbers there by a factor of a few. Again, there are some nuclei even with possibly better shift suppression factors by a factor of a few. So in all these numbers, there's a possibility for enhancement of a factor of a few. Similarly, let me also just point out this term here. This is the resonant enhancement. So you can see when the axion mass is matched to the Larmor frequency, this is some large resonant enhancement. The idea then would be just like ADMX, this is a resonant experiment, so you have to scan. Here, unlike in ADMX, instead of changing the position of some bar within the cavity to change the resonant frequency of the cavity, you scan by changing the external applied magnetic field to change what axion mass you're looking for. And we'll just consider a sample size around 10 centimeters, and I'll take a squid magnetometer, which is around 10 to the minus 16 tesla per root hertz for a pickup coil around 10 centimeters. By the way, just to note that the newest atomic magnetometers that have been built are about a factor of 10 better than that. We won't assume that because a squid is much easier to build. But again, there's possibility for improvement in the magnetometer as well, potentially significant improvement. And finally, I wanted to point out that essentially this is more, you think of it as like a phase measurement. You're getting here a signal proportional just to 1 power of d, not the square. Okay, let's see. So I just want to very rapidly mention some of the important details. So we want as large an applied electric field as we can, of course, since the signal scales with that, the precession rate scales with that. Largest electric fields you can get are from things like ferroelectrics, where let's say in this case the lead nucleus or whatever is displaced from the centrosymmetric position in the crystal lattice. So if you're at the center, of course, if you have some symmetry, then you can't have an electric field acting on that atom. But once you're off the center, you can, and in general will, in a solid. The electric fields in a solid are generally very large. So this, for example, I'm using lead titanate, which is a ferroelectric crystal. But we know the electric fields in such, in general, the electric fields in these solids are much larger than you can apply in the lab. I should also point out as a technical note that we actually don't need to use a ferroelectric. Really, any polar crystal where this is displaced is fine because we don't need to adjust this dynamically, unlike the solid-state EDM experiments. That may, again, allow a factor of a few enhancement or so in this number. Also, significantly improved systematics. One of the biggest systematic background problems for these, for the previous, for solid-state EDM-type experiments was that they kept reversing this applied electric field. When you reverse such a big electric field, some things in your material change. We don't need to do that. We have a naturally AC signal, so we won't be generating backgrounds at the same frequency as our signal. Okay, let's see. Let me very rapidly just point out the strength of this coherence, the strength of this resonant enhancement, of course, is limited by however strong your coherence can be. In particular, it's limited by the fundamental width of the axion. I won't assume what Pierre assumed, although if Pierre's right about the axion, this would even be a further boost to our sensitivity. That would be great for our experiment. I'll just assume that the axion has, of course, roughly a frequency set by the axion mass with some spread. The width of the frequency distribution is just given by the kinetic energy in the galaxy. Since the variable velocity of the galaxy is about 10 to the minus 3, that's a fractional spread in the resonance of about 10 to the minus 6. So that means we can get a resonant enhancement about 10 to the 6 or so. Actually, that's not always the most relevant quantity because we're also cut off by the Q of our experiment, if you like. We're talking about precession, this Larmor frequency, the precession of these nuclear spins around the applied external magnetic field. But there will be some transverse nuclear spin dephasing time as they precess. In NMR language, that's called T2. So for example, if you have two spins, precessing around this magnetic field because of small local B field inhomogeneities, because of local spin-spin interactions, all those sorts of things, they don't precess at exactly the same rate. You can just calculate that approximately, essentially, for any material. It's more or less the same. And you can find a T2 of around a millisecond. So that would be one limit. That's if you do nothing to the material. Of course, the nice thing is that the NMR community has already designed many ways around this and demonstrated them for many years now. So for example, these careful NMR pulse sequences they've designed, called dynamic decoupling, for example, they've demonstrated factors of many orders of magnitude improvement in this T2, up to, I think, the longest that I'm aware of is a T2 around 1,000 seconds in xenon. The only theoretical limit to T2 is T1, this longitudinal spin dephasing time, demagnetization time, which is hours. Okay. Finally, let's see, I just wanted to point out, there's also this polarization fraction. Again, if you do nothing else to the material, you get a polarization fraction, just besides cool it, get a polarization fraction around 10 to the minus 3. Again, these designed NMR pulse sequences have allowed them already to demonstrate polarization fractions order 1 in some materials. Okay, so let me just sort of very quickly summarize. This is my crude cartoon for how such an experiment would go. Phase one, let's say, for example, that really, of course, be much more complicated than this in any real experiment. Phase one, if you don't imagine doing anything, then just take what you get just by putting material in this external magnetic field using these parameters, P of 10 to the minus 3 and a millisecond for T2. Phase two, once you start using these designed NMR pulse sequences, you can improve these numbers. So I'll just show you the sensitivity for both. I just wanted to comment. If you just measure the transverse magnetization of a sample of material, you will, of course, see some noise. Any material has some background magnetization noise. You can calculate that approximately. That's been done, and I'll show you the limit from that. Though really, I mean, it's sort of like, again, similar to WIMP detection, right? It's not like we know exactly what our backgrounds will be. I think really, for any given material, you'll have to go in and measure it and figure out where this background is coming from. But you can estimate the level. Okay, so just to show you our results, so here's the plot of the axion parameter space in this coupling to photons versus the axion mass. I didn't make this figure. So here, this yellow band here is the QCD axion, because again, the QCD axion is all determined by this one parameter, FA. And left of this red line here, below about a milliEV in mass, that's where the QCD axion can be dark matter. This gray band here, this is the limit from ADMX, the current limit from ADMX, and this green is where ADMX projects they'll be able to go in the next few years. So you can see sort of covering this higher axion mass window of parameter space. But of course, what's sort of, and here are the light through walls and all the astrophysical constraints, but what's obvious from this is that it's difficult to go to low mass and low coupling. So by contrast, here's our plot. I have to put it on a different parameter space because it's a different operator. It's a different coupling. But here's the strength of that coupling, the gluons, really the strength of this dipole moment coupling, versus the mass of the axion. This purple region is the QCD axion parameter space. The dark purple is where it could most naturally be dark matter. This is M Planck here, so I cut it off below that. we recalculated the supernova limits for this new operator, so here they are. Here are the limits from the best static EDM experiments. You can see they're many, many orders of magnitude weaker, essentially because they're integrating over hundreds of seconds. So they're essentially completely insensitive to this rapidly oscillating signal. And here, although I can't really put the limits from ADMX in this parameter space, I can put them on the QCD axion, right, because they only use the coupling to photons. So here are the current limits from ADMX. So here's our projected possible sensitivities. This orange is the phase one curve. You can see covering a lot of this axion-like particle parameter space. And the red is this phase two with these NMR pulse sequences, which can even get you down to covering several orders of magnitude of the QCD axion parameter space. Everything, this corresponds to an F of about the gut scale, from the gut scale to the Planck scale. And here this dotted curve is the estimate of the magnetization noise, the irreducible noise in this experiment. So it looks like it won't be a problem, but like I said, actually you actually have to measure it in any real experiment. Okay, so since I'm essentially out of time, let me skip a couple. Let me just point out that the reason we were making an improvement here, we were using this EDM coupling, which is a non-derivative coupling of the axion, allowing you to reach high FA. I also want to point out the many options for future improvements. As I said, in all these things, at least factors of a few in many of these factors. A crucial point is that because you have an AC signal, you get this resonant enhancement, this large Q, which helps you also, because it's an AC signal, helps you reject noise. So let me just summarize. So here's the axion parameter space again for the QCD axion. Here's what can be covered by ADMX. It looks like our searches, this idea is best in this high F window, actually sort of the reverse of every other possibility using the FF dual operator. And I think there will, you know, there are serious technological challenges in doing an experiment like this. I view it sort of similarly to the early stages of WIMP detection. Obviously, in the past 25 or so years in WIMP detection, we've come a long way. It required a lot of difficult experimental work. I'm sure this would be the same. But I think that the axion is very well motivated. And as I've said, I see no other way to look for it over a big chunk of its parameter space. So I think it's well worth it. I think it's a worthy goal. It could well be the dark matter, and I think if you discover it, of course, it's a discovery not just of the dark matter, but some glimpse into the physics happening at these very high energy scales, far above what any collider can probe. So, thank you.
Sensitive to the axiverse axions, the ultralight axions? Can you get down to that range?
Okay, so it depends what you mean. Let me show you here's our sensitivity. So it depends what you mean by axiverse axion, but this is an FA of around the gut scale. So we're sensitive even down to the QCD axion, and in general, sometimes what is meant by axiverse is all these axion-like particles, you know, a general axion-like particle. So then, yes, if I understand your question.
But they do go down to much lower masses too, don't they?
Good. Okay. So could we go below? So I sort of have thought most carefully in these few orders of magnitude of parameter space. Different frequencies do change the experiment significantly, obviously. And this is already several orders of magnitude. I haven't thought too carefully below this because this, for the QCD axion, is the Planck scale. So I'm not sure how to make a model that has an FA higher than the Planck scale, let's say, without a theory of quantum gravity. But in general, yeah, if I'm not talking about the QCD axion, absolutely, I agree with you. One could think about going to much lower masses. I think that something like the techniques I've been talking about is probably the right way to go. Like I said, this is what doesn't suffer from this axion mass suppression, this axion wavelength suppression. So I think that would be really exciting. This exact technique I'm talking about probably isn't the best way to do it because you can see here, so the highest frequency we can probe is actually set by the largest magnetic field we can turn on in the lab. Because right, we have to have the Larmor frequency of the precession of the nucleus matched to the frequency here, the frequency of the axion. But similarly, not only so this is a limit of like 10 tesla or so, but there's also a limit at the low end, which is the lowest magnetic field you can apply in the lab, which might sound funny, but it's really the lowest field you can have in a sample of material. So I don't know exactly what the lowest field, I haven't tried to think carefully what the lowest field you can have in a sample of material is, but I'm fairly certain you can go down to about this frequency. Significantly lower might be challenging. I mean, any material has some magnetic field. So, I mean, you can try to cancel it and stuff, but.
I was wondering whether you could discuss a bit more the parameter epsilon s.
Oh, yeah, sure.
You mentioned that it vanishes, but if the nucleus has no size, it is zero.
Good, yes, that's right. So essentially, right, so you know, Schiff's theorem to give it the fancy name, is if you have electrostatic equilibrium, like an atom, and you apply some electric field across the atom, then if you are in electrostatic equilibrium, any charged particle must have zero electric field on it, or you wouldn't be in equilibrium, in static equilibrium. So if you apply, since an atom is approximately electrostatic equilibrium, if you apply an electric field across an atom, and the nucleus is a point charge, approximately, then if you apply an electric field across an atom, the nucleus will have essentially zero electric field on it. So you cannot have the we're using the D dot E interaction, right? Dipole moment dot electric field. If you don't have, if the electrons all rearrange themselves somehow to give you essentially zero electric field on the nucleus, then you won't have an effect. Right? So then leading order, this would be zero. But of course, all those things I said were only approximate. There are subleading order corrections. So the first correction to the dipole moment is the shift moment. And the shift moment is proportional to, so the corrections come because the nucleus is finite size and things are not static. They are moving, so there are relativistic corrections. So the shift moment is proportional to the size of the nucleus. Really, actually, the technically correct description is probably if you have any the splitting between the lowest lying opposite parity states in the nucleus. For hydrogen, the shift suppression would be something like 10 to the minus 9 because the nucleus is very small. But when you go up to, so roughly the shift suppression, very approximately, is 10 to the minus 9 times z cubed. So you win very rapidly with going to large z. That's why for these large z, the shift suppression is actually only a factor of 10 to the minus a few. In fact, you can go even to weirder nuclei, these light actinides, like radium, plutonium, things like that, which have very low-lying opposite parity states in the nucleus. And there, the shift suppressions are not suppressions. They're one, or even some of them are enhancements, because you're mixing low-lying parity levels, which is always a good way to win, a low, small energy denominator. So that's, you could even have things with much larger shift moments, but those are very hard to work with.
Go back to the plot where you showed the sensitivity mm-hmm. of phase one and phase two. I understand the vertical line. I was trying to figure out why you get this particular shape.
Ah, okay, yes.
For the sensitivity. So I understand the vertical line depends on the frequency, so the magnetic field.
Mm-hmm. Biggest magnetic field you can apply. Yeah, we assume 10 and 20 tesla.
Right, and then what happens? For instance, you have this broken.
Good, here, yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's going on there? What's going on is there, as I've assumed a, I might not even have said this actually, so thanks for bringing this up. I assumed a T2 time, the transverse spin dephasing time, mm-hmm. of 1 second. Mm-hmm. So right here, this is an axion frequency you can see of just about a megahertz. So a period of a microsecond. The Q factor, the fundamental width of the axion dark matter, is at least 10 to the 6. So that means axion coherence time of 1 second. So right here is where the axion coherence time matches the T2, I assumed, this transverse spin dephasing time. So when you're left of that, the axion, let me get the sign right, the axion frequency is lower, so the axion coherence time is longer, but that doesn't help you. So actually, by the way, because the reason these curves are slanting as you go left is because you have more integration time. You have longer times here, longer axion coherence times. But so that's why this curve is fairly steep. That no longer helps you once you're left of here because of what I've assumed about the experimental parameters. You could do better if you could make a better T2, but I've assumed only 1 second. So that's why you have the break here. So here, below here, you win only like T to the 1/4, essentially, with integration time. Above here, you can win like square root of T. So yeah, okay, does that begin to explain?
That answers the question. Very quick question is, so usually when I see the plots, so where they show basically where the QCD axion can produce the right relic density,
mm-hmm.
It's more or less around the ADMX diffusion. Mm-hmm. Can you get enough, all of the dark matter in the form of a QCD axion if you like a mass of 10 to the minus 12 electron volts?
Right, exactly. Good. So this is, let me go back to it, here, sort of what I was trying to say here.
Mm-hmm.
So absolutely, you can see, so you have to, in order to get the axion to be dark matter, you have to satisfy this relation. You can see if F is too small, it cannot possibly satisfy this relation, and therefore you cannot get all the dark matter. So for F lower than about 10 to the 10 or 10 to the 11 GeV, it can only possibly be a subdominant component. For higher F, it's no problem being all the dark matter. However, you have to satisfy this relation. So like I said, something has to be small. Yeah. And that's why I said I would expand what has been, was often previously claimed as the window in which you had to have the axion dark matter was just right here, because you believe theta had to be order 1. But like I said, I don't really see any reason not to consider the whole parameter space. I should say, as a technical point, I'm taking, in order to get theta small, you have to take the PQ transition to be above the scale of inflation.
I said a quick question about the figure that Gene Franco mentioned as well. Can you go back to that?
Which
the one, the previous exclusion figure?
This figure?
So usually, I think in the standard scenario, axions around us, electron volt or so, are supposedly ruled out because they're thermally produced in the early universe and they're warm dark matter. Is that not a limit in this case because it's a different model, or?
Okay.
Is it
no.
Not
so good. There can be, actually, maybe you want to go back to this plot here. Okay. So well, let's see. I don't know if actually I didn't make this plot, so I can't tell you where that limit is here. Right, so I've mostly focused only on axions below milli-EV because that's where they could be the dark matter. So I wasn't worrying about limits like that. But yes, I mean, you're right, I made this plot. I may well have left off some limit over here. I was really only worrying about where they could be all the dark matter.
But in principle, that limit actually goes on this figure as well. Is that true or no?
There will definitely be thermal production using this operator. Yeah, it would have to be recalculated using this operator because now I'm assuming only this coupling, just like the previous slide assumes the photon coupling. But
any more questions for Peter? Okay, let's thank him again.